NWP Radio.
You're listening to NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project.
NWP.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today, we're talking with Dan Levinson, author of the new book, Song of Six Rivers, about teaching, writing poetry, his relationship to his local writing project site. I'm your host, Tanya Baker, at the NWP in Berkeley, California. Hi, Dan. Welcome to NWP Radio.
Hi, Tanya. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Oh, we're so happy to have you here, too. I'd love it if you would just introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. My name is Dan. The book is published under Zev Levinson, and that's my middle name, and that's how I've always published my work. Just for listeners to know, if they're interested, Zev means wolf in the Hebrew language. It was my great-grandfather's Hebrew name, and I tell my students about pen names when I'm teaching. I was born in Berkeley, relevant for the National Writing Project.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in San Jose, went to UC Santa Cruz, lived in Israel for a little while as a little kid, moved up here to Humboldt County, and I've got different master's degrees from here, moved to North Carolina, got a master's in fine arts and creative writing from Greensboro there. That's mainly it. I used to be the flower man, Dan the Flower Man in Arcata and Eureka here in Humboldt, and that is referenced in the poem. That's the quick version.
Wow. It sounds like there's a lot we could unpack there, actually.
I was a stagehand in the Bay Area.
Really? At a particular theater?
My older brother is a lifer, my brother Dave, and he's in the Stagehands Union. I worked with Bill Graham Presents. I worked with UC Regents there at Zellerbach and the Greek. I worked with the De Anza Foothill Colleges. So, rock concerts and plays and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, we could probably someday unpack that because we have several friends in the East Bay who worked for Bill Graham Presents as well. So I bet if we spent not too long over a drink, we'd find some people we know.
Yep.
But now you are... you have been Dan the Flower Man in Arcata, but you seem to be pretty settled, at least right now, in that area, and have been a long time active participant in the Redwood Writing Project. And we'd love to hear a little bit about unpacking that history too. What's your long term relationship with the Writing Project?
Yeah, you bet. Dan the Flower Man is ancient history. I think officially became a member with the Redwood Writing Project in 2001. At the time, the directors were Bob Sizo and Susan Bennett, if I recall correctly. Bob Sizo, he created, it was called the Advanced Summer Institute, and I was probably one of the very few people who went to that right away when I became a fellow of the Redwood Writing Project. And that took place out at Camp Matol, out on the Lost Coast. And that's a whole other story, but it's really central to the poem, to my book. The book is an epic poem. And over time, when funding dried up, it stopped being a Redwood Writing Project retreat, but the retreat still continues and is now called the Lost Coast Writers Retreat. It's all wrapped up together. And one other thing I maybe should mention is that I've been a poet teacher with California Poets in the Schools for 20 years. And every time I teach in a school, I actually advertise the Redwood Writing Project's Young Writers Camp, sometimes called the Young Writers Academy. Also, we sometimes have the Young Writers Conference. And so I get a bunch of kids showing up in the summer because of my advertising it. And so in my world, California Poets in the Schools and the Redwood Writing Project, or on the larger scale, NWP, they are all very much tied together, all wrapped up together.
That is fantastic. And I don't know if anybody has ever said, though it probably happens in other places, how to connect those two things. Because most places have poets in the schools programs, and what a great advertisement when kids are getting to do this really interesting out of their regular day writing with someone for the writing project summer camps for kids. That's fantastic. Brilliant.
Yeah. And I'm one of the rare people who tries to do California Poets in the Schools mostly as a living. Most other people have other jobs, and you know, yeah. I'm an editor on the side, but I try to fill my whole school year calendar with different school each week. So
that's
that.
Fantastic and a little epic.
It is. It is, and that's how I've gotten to know our area so well, is because I often stay for a week in places that are far enough away that I am not going to drive home after I teach, because I have got enough homework. So I really get to know Humboldt and other counties by staying in different communities.
Oh, how lovely.
Thanks.
So I know you mentioned the importance, the centrality of this writing retreat to your writing project site. And I also know that when I first reached out to see if I could find you for an interview, you were out of pocket at that writing retreat. I wonder if you want to tell us a little bit about your experience with that.
Sure. Part of me and all of the other campers at the retreat hesitate to talk about it because we've got a limited amount of people who can go, and it is paradise. So Humboldt County itself, you know, is just incredibly gorgeous. We've got the redwoods, we've got the ocean, we've got the mountains. We don't have a huge population, and we've got great communities here. Mm. Now, the Lost Coast is the stretch of California where there is no highway along the coast. And there's just one main road, and some other roads out there a little bit, but it's totally funky, totally dangerous. and so you are isolated, and it's just incredibly beautiful. And the retreat takes place at Camp Matole, sometimes called Matole Camp. It's an old Presbyterian-owned camp, and different groups rent it out. They do need more campers to pay the bills, by the way, so people should look that up. But it's a camp. Think of a summer camp when you were a kid, and it's right on the Matole River. That's named after the Matole tribe of Native Americans. Matole means clear water. We are now out there for 9 nights at a time. Not everybody can stay for 9 nights. But we're out there, and we've gotten it to the place now where we actually have to have a waiting list, and it's going to get really complicated, but we try to keep the numbers low so that we can have a certain degree of intimacy, sense of family out there. We have workshops that we give we will offer ourselves to each other, but nobody is obliged to do anything. You can just go off and write all you want to your heart's content, whether that's in the lodge or in a cabin or in your tent or, whatever. And by the way, we call it the Redwood Eating Project because we eat so well out there. We used to actually have paid presenters out there. We would have published authors show up then we would pay them a good chunk of money, and then we would try to get enough campers to show up, and that cost more money. So that was difficult, and one of our members, Guy Kuttner, who is the muse of my poem, he kept reminding us, hey, you know, if we are working too hard doing this, let's just rent the camp ourselves and be a collective. And we decided to do that, and the year we decided to do it, he pretty suddenly passed away from a pretty rare disease. I think it was called a disease. And I talk about that in the preface of my book. And so that was his gift. One of his great gifts to us. And that's the format we've stuck with now for 6 or 7 or 8 years.
That is a writing project story in so many ways. And it does sound pretty much like writing project paradise. So
yeah.
We'll try to keep it on the down low, but now you've just told the whole network about it. So
I know. It's all over. Yeah.
So also this really great description of the place where you live and where this camp is a really great introduction, I think, to us moving to talk about the poem, because the poem is so much in this place. So, and writing project educators will be, many of them will have a frame of like place-based education or place-based writing. And it seems, as I was reading your poem, I was like, well, nobody could bring a more sort of deeply placed piece of writing than your new book, Song of Six Rivers. So you have told us a little bit about where you live and write, but is there anything else you would like to tell us about the place that's the setting for this poem?
Sure. So Humboldt County really is special. People up here refer to it as living behind the redwood curtain. And there are, the poem starts out with referencing the elder poets. It begins, "The elder poets close their books and turn in time to Alder White," something like that. And I'm not looking at it right now. Hard to memorize 500 and something lines. Mm-hmm. But the elder poets around me are people like Jerry Martine, who's some people consider him the poet laureate of Humboldt County. And Jim is a poet as well as a fiction writer. And there are others. There are these older mentor teachers around me. One person just passed away named Freeman House, who's should be more famous, but is well known for his book Totem Salmon. And so these are the guys who, you know, some of them were considered the diggers, you know, back around the time of the, you know, the hippies in the 60s. Mm-hmm. There was that movement of the back to the landers here in the 70s. People trying to, you know, they were getting away from getting away from the big cities.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. I was just going to say being square in all the ways.
Square, but yeah. So there was a real back to the land movement here. People often not knowing what they were doing and scratching a living out of the land here, and really learning how to do it. And they were often in conflict with the old timers who were the ranchers. On top of this, of course, way, way, way on top of it and way, way, way beneath it are the layers of the Native Americans who lived here for who knows
right.
You know, how many thousands and thousands of years. And, and that's unfortunately a similar story to the rest of the United States. The tribes do continue here, though. Some of the tribes, they actually survived more intact than in other parts of the United States. The Europeans came here and decimated them, basically. But that's a part of our sense of place here. The Wiat tribe is strong. The Yurok, the Karuk, the Hoopa, there are a number of them. And I continue to learn all about that. So there, one can't live here for too long without getting a real sense of place, unless you are just blind and deaf and not paying attention. It's called Song of Six Rivers, and it's mainly about Humboldt County. And when I have been giving readings of the book, you know, I'm telling the audience at the start, like, well, who am I to have written this authoritative poem when I've lived here less than 30 years. And I'm reading it to people who were born here and grew up here. Sometimes they are referred to as Frumbolts.
Frumbolts, right? I love it.
If you're from Humboldt, you're a Frumbolt. And so I consider this a song of Six Rivers, not the song of Six Rivers. It's one of my songs. It doesn't have everything in it, and other people are going to have their own versions. But yes, it is a natural paradise. You know, people love to go backpacking and camping, and it's just super sweet little communities, hanging out in the cafes and seeing people you know every day. Yesterday, walking the dog, you know, my partner and I ran into a Jerry Martin's sister walking her dog. So, you know, that's just how it is.
Well, you know, really, you probably should stop talking because you are making it sound so perfect. I'm afraid you're going to be overrun with writing project poets.
But the economy here is hard to make a living here.
Yes, of course. That's always the cost-benefit analysis in a place like that, right? To sound like a corporate person, but city person. I think your point about yourself as the ideal writer for A Song of Six Rivers and who you're talking to is an interesting one. And I wonder, as you were writing, if you imagine an ideal audience for this poem.
Yeah, you know, when I was writing it, I didn't think that much about a particular audience. I just thought, you know, I was nearing 50 at the time when I started to write it, and I was thinking about legacy and what I'm going to leave behind. And that ties in with my father dying when I was 14, and he left a strong legacy. So I've got that in me. So I was actually kind of thinking of writing a great poem that everybody would love, you know, like any author wants to. One of my editing clients is this Swedish guy named Joachim Andersson. He's a poet. He found me online. He ordered the book, and he recently wrote to me, I hope it reaches its intended readers, whom I imagine are young and old locals and newcomers who want to feel a connection to the land. Now, that's all true, but I really did want it to be bigger than that. When you put out a book, who knows what the audience is going to be? One can only hope it reaches way beyond my immediate circles.
Well, I can tell you another, having heard you just unpack that, I can tell you that another welcoming audience for a book like this are people in their 50s thinking about their place in the world and a legacy, which many things you've said, I'm like, oh, no wonder I really resonated with this book. But I feel like that makes a lot of sense to me as a person of a certain age thinking about legacy and work and place in the world. I think the book is very appealing in the way that it ruminates on these questions. So.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think about that stuff a lot. I don't much hold back in the schools when I'm teaching. I will sometimes teach little kids a lesson plan that I've put together called Last Day on Earth. If it were your last day on Earth, what would be your legacy? What would you leave behind? Whom would you want to thank and say goodbye to? That sounds heavy, and it can be, but the schools love this stuff because it's making the kids really think.
You know? Right. Yeah. I bet the kids really love it too. They really like to be asked to think about things that matter, and that totally matters.
Yes. Yeah. They like to be taken seriously.
So. Yeah. So, could you share, after all this talk about the book, I know the writers and teachers who are in our audience are going to want to hear some of it. Would you share an excerpt with us?
I would love to. Thank you. Let's see here. So early on, I am asking myself about legacy. What's the point of it all? And so I've got this one stanza. And by the way, the stanzas are in, they're six lines each, sort of mirroring the six rivers. There is a rhyme scheme. There is a certain meter to it as well. Hopefully I did it gracefully enough that it's, done well. So this one stanza goes, "But what am I to paint or write? Oh, hermitage within my heart. One missing poet calls to me a message that I must deliver. For in guise, name, I breathe this world. Remember ashes on the river." And then Guy starts talking to me from the beyond and telling me that my purpose is what I need to do is sing this land. And so we hear Guy's voice. But then after my moments of wondering and hesitation and doubt and crisis, here's the next part that I'm going to read. And it goes on for a few minutes, but it's pretty representative, I think, of the poem. destroy the decade's decadence. A chorus builds and I head south. Dispelling ghosts with cobweb minds, I follow salmon to the mouth. All species singing, mountains moan until the earth is made anew. With redwood sprung from molten speech, all trees unfurling what is true, that deer and quail receive as blessings, a grandeur of this forest vast, releasing crystal elixirs, wrought unperceived in eons past. We sip the wisdom of John Muir, as of authors write, these trees limbed by his fractious voice, these trees with crowns beyond our sight. Sequoia's temper virens tower along our rocky, shifting coast. Sequoia dendra, gigantea, loom until we feel lost. Metasequoia, glyptostroboides, transplanted from the Chinese shores, as graceful as the dawn, on dew, reminding us to fling wide our doors. Such shadow-casting ancient beings are as the roiling blue Pacific, and if I grasp for any essence of moments, flashing, and specific, I find impossible the task, as opened moments steal my thoughts, till I become another mote, with millions in a sunbeam caught, who dance among these endless forms, sword ferns that frame scintillant whales, a mountain lion asleep in sorrel, banana slugs and fox's trails, all leading from my brain to heart. Diversity eludes compare and folds and frees this laden soul and renders me at last aware. Aware and awake, I heave my howl while Yurok drift into the mist, gold dust debasing noble visage. At Whitey's Gulch, Sage Liz insists she's seen the albino silhouette and heard the medicine man's chant. Across the veil from Ketamine, where deerskinned Karuk proudly danced, a discreet shape has lumbered past. The locals cringe as something shrieks, a beast, some say, that has no name, but others claim they hear it speak. The children of these broken tribes, still mourning countless crooked losses, they look to me for unearthed poems and bear their totems by church crosses. Can all this naming be enough? These poems all I have to give. Will they hold as lasting proof, imperative, why I have lived? The Hoopa and the Sinkion upon these vital lands did reign, whose villages were burned and torn, whose kin fought only to be slain. I've hearkened to the Wiat songs, helped restore mysteries as I can. I've eaten from their hidden gardens, no longer dream utopian. Some dynasties shall walk no more. There is no way we can appease those spirits without resting place, nor in the nightmare make it cease. Such prayers as could cleave the clouds, I wing unto those hearts of sorrow. Salute the sun of future days. Compose a song meant for tomorrow. And I'm going to stop there. And I want to mention, by the way, I used the word limbed regarding John Muir, and it's L-I-M-N-E-D. It puns on the word limbs of trees, but it's to illustrate, to detail, to delineate. It's related to illuminare, as in decorated manuscripts, illuminated manuscripts.
Yes, I noticed that actually when I read the text, but thanks, because as I will point out in a minute, people can't see your text or the book that it's been crafted into, and I want to talk about that too. But I want to say, I think this is lovely, and it captures something of your place and something of yourself. And I was listening and thinking, this is the second or third time for me with this poem, and I was thinking about the respectful attention of all that naming and how important it is, and how what a special way that is to pay respect to a place and to honor it. And then the line, "Can all this naming be enough?" arose. So I want to say Maybe not enough, but yes, so beautiful, so important.
Yeah, thank you. I tried. And I rewrote it at one point too. I tried harder.
Trying and then trying harder is really kind of what the process is about, which we'll talk about in a minute too. But before we talk about your process, I want to say that your poem is beautiful. And then what listeners on radio can't see is it's been put together into this really lovely, beautiful book. So I would love for you to describe it a little bit and maybe explain how this book got designed.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's published by Humboldt State University Press. And when I pitched it to Kyle Morgan, who's the head of HSU Press, and he works at the library here, he said, yeah, let's do this. I see this as a visual project. And stupid me, I thought, I guess, okay, sure, images, duh. Well, it turned out to be this incredibly beautiful project because what happened was, there was a team who put the book together, and the main designer is named C.M. Phillips. Her name is Cindy, but she goes by C.M. Phillips. She's a friend of mine, it turned out, coincidentally, in our little community here. So Cindy and Ashley Schumann, they went through over 12,000 photos, archival historical photos from Humboldt State's special collections, mostly that the public had never seen before. They narrowed those numbers down to, you know, just a handful that got into the book. And there are also four contemporary images from two local authors in the book. And so there is photography on every page of the book. And my partner, Jen Rand, she also helped with the design. Cindy and I ended up what she calls arm wrestling a bit sometimes. I really wanted initially just the text on one page on one side, you know, with just a white background, and then the photo over on the facing page. And she's an artist and as well as a writer and as well as a techie. And so, you know, she was very much blending the photos with the text, and I kept saying, back it off, let the text stand, let the text breathe, let people read it. And she would say, but. And so we did a bit of that. And sometimes, you know, I said, oh, this picture doesn't work here, and can we move things around? But that's how it got done. And I'm super lucky because, I mean, places like pharmacies here are carrying the book, and it's not because it's an epic poem about our area. It's because it looks so cool. and people love the history around here, and you will see other historical books of photos in our pharmacies as well as in our bookstores. And so that allows me to pitch it to bookstores all over, so far all over California. I haven't gone out of California yet, but because it's available through Ingram. I mean, I know we may talk more about where it's, you know, how to get the book later, but it's available through Ingram, which is the largest book distributor in the US. And so Humboldt State University Press doesn't have the machinery in place to really get the book out into the world very far. And as things are often in the publishing industry these days, it's down to the author. And I'm calling up bookstores. You know, I've called all of them around you. I've called half of them in California probably, and just say, hey, can I send it a quick email that, you know, shows you this book? And they go, wow, all right. And they often order a copy or two.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. We will talk, we'll remind everybody at the end how they can find the book if they're interested, but I would argue that the combination of the photographs and the beautifully naming and evocative and respectful attention to the place in the words would make anybody who's there and who loves that place want to own this book. But also, I think a lot of people who are interested in the place or in place in general and its importance should love this
book. Thank you. Thank you. I sometimes think that the photos almost tell a second narrative, and you know, and a lot of Native Americans are represented. And I think I'm going to get in trouble at some point from some Native Americans and whoever else are going to get upset that, you know, we've used some images, but we did have the rights to all of them through Humboldt State. So I was doing my absolute best to honor everybody and honor the land.
It really comes across, I think.
Great.
So many of our listeners are writing project teacher consultants, which means they are writers who teach and teachers who write, and they never want me to let a published author come talk about their work without talking about their process. So I would love for you to share a little bit about your process and as a writer in general, and maybe particularly in making this book. So I don't know where you want to start, but maybe you just want to tell us a little bit about what your writing day or your writing life looks like.
Sure. Yeah, I'll start generally. I wish I were a daily writer like everybody else. I think I saw Jane Hirschfield read up here some years ago, and she was saying, "Oh, I'm not the disciplined daily writer that everybody says we're supposed to be. You know, the poems come when they come." And that's unfortunately that's sometimes true for me. But one good thing about teaching, and one of the many things about teaching poetry in the schools, is that there's writing time in the classroom every day. I make, you know, the kids have to write, and I'm usually helping them out. But when I can, I'm working on poems too, and that forces me to write poetry. Yay! it's sort of a machine that makes me write poetry. As the was it the surrealist who called it a machine, or the group from Oulipo? Anyway, I'm getting out there in the literary world. I think I would write more on a daily basis, but I am scattered. I am busy doing this California Poets in the Schools thing. You know, I have to get most of my work myself by emailing all these schools in my county and beyond. I'm my own secretary. You know, I'm an editor on the side. You know, we're all busy people. So, yeah, I wish I were more disciplined. I don't write that much stuff outside of poetry. I do write some prose sometimes. I actually put a whole book together about teaching poetry in the schools and didn't try too hard to get that published, so I need to revisit that. But I did write a lot of prose for that, of course. Mm-hmm. Regarding this poem, I think I knew it was going to be an epic poem when I started writing it. I did know it to a certain extent. I didn't know how long it was going to be. And I started writing it out at Camp Matol during a retreat, you know, several years ago, and maybe wrote half of it or something. And having a rhyme scheme and having a meter, that was another machine that helped me keep going and going and going. And I found that very useful, because I'm working on another epic poem now, which I can't talk too much about because I'm in the middle of it. But I'm enjoying this process, and I did share the early version of, I shared an early draft with Jim Dodge, and he, you know, he kind of tore it to pieces. Fortunately for me, he thought the rhyme scheme wasn't working so well. He didn't think the stanza structure was working so well. And that's why I went ahead and rewrote it. And the poem did get much better for that. So I think I wrote the second half of the poem when I got home during the rest of that summer. And then, you know, worked away on it for however long it took. I can't remember how long it took. I think a few years. but like I said, I'm really enjoying this process of working in a form, that structure that I can work with. And I, as a young writer, you know, even before I was really into poetry, those sorts of poems would just come out, you know, where I was just playing with rhyme and meter. So that does come naturally to me. Over time, I got much more into free verse where I didn't have rhymes. And so I do both. I really do a lot of both. But I am finding now, I guess, being in my 50s, that, all right, you know, clock's ticking. What do I have to say to the world? What am I going to leave behind? And you know, not to compare myself to you know, the epic poets of, let's say, the British Romantic 19th century, you know, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Keats, Shelley. But I soaked those guys up quite a bit, especially as a young writer. And I know this can sound silly to people anytime that progressive rock is invoked. But I'm an old fan of prog rock, and there are epic songs, and when you read the lyrics, they are epic poems, and it stuck, and I'm in a sense trying to emulate that. So that's mostly my process.
That's fantastic, and I love that. I first of all love when writers talk about the benefits of constraint in poetry. It usually comes up with poetry, but it also comes up with people who write really short, like those micro stories, and how that those constraints can really drive the engine. I think that's great. That's really interesting. And I love the far-reaching set of mentors that you bring in. I think it's fantastic, actually. So people love to have conversations about particular works. I'm just going to ask you a couple follow-up questions about making A Song of Six Rivers. What came easy in this poem?
Yeah, well, so what came easy was, I can't say the loss of Guy Kuttner came easy. It was devastating. He died 7 years ago now, but he made the poem come easy. He had died, I can't remember now. I think he died 3 years, maybe a little more than that, before I started writing the poem. And so he's the muse of the poem. I met him and his wife, Cindy, at my very first, Advanced Summer Institute out at Camp Matoll, you know, which has become our Lost Coast Writers Retreat. Became fairly close with them, just loved them. And so when I took on this poem, I thought, oh, you know, maybe I can start writing about this place that I've gotten to know so well. And so I was really channeling Guy. And and that's what came easy, and it just kept propelling it. It just kept going and going, and it's, you know, and my dad is wrapped up in the poem a bit as well, and I think I mentioned he died when I was 14, and so having that sort of stuff, even though it's really painful to maybe talk or write about, it makes the writing kind of easy because we really have something to say about it, you know, when you've experienced some devastation. So when I read the poem in front of people to an audience, you know, I'll end up crying. But I think, the audiences kind of like it for its authenticity.
Exactly.
Know? Yeah. So I think that's what came easy. And then, I probably made notes along the way as I was going, like, oh, I can write about this and I can write about this. And so I would maybe finish certain areas and then get to the next ones.
Yeah. And what do you think was the hardest?
The hardest was, well, again, I'm really grateful that Jim Dodge called me on my certain my use of rhyme and meter and stuff like that, and so I guess making the language really sing, because I'm one of the, I'm on board with most people who, you know, teach poetry and talk about poetry and say, oh, you know, it's got to sound good or else it's not going to work and history isn't going to remember it. And so I'm all about sound, and you know, I think sound is perhaps 50% of the poetry. So yeah, making it sound good, making it not be clunky, and rewriting it sure helped. And I learned so much about working in those constraints for such a long period of time in such a long poem that it's definitely informing the way I'm writing now. It's been really beneficial.
That's really interesting. I just want to say that I think you're in good company, because when I know you already know this because you said many poets talk about sound, but when Donald Hall passed away, like 2 weeks ago, right? Someone sent me an interview he'd done years ago, and it opens with him doing this really great reading and saying the poem's all about the sound, and it should hurt to read a poem silently. Like it should like be straining against, you know, for your desire to like make it sound. So
yeah.
I think I partly spurred by a comment you made earlier about like naming things, working hard at it, and then working harder. I think a question young people often ask us, and we ask ourselves as writers, this is the last question I'm going to ask you about your process on Song of Six Rivers, but how did you know when you were done?
Well, the poem took a turn as I was writing it, probably towards the end, maybe 2/3 of the way through it, maybe 3/5 of the way through. I don't know how far it is. But I didn't know this was going to happen until I was actually writing it. And, you know, I'm in the poem, I'm singing of the land and naming all these places. And then all of a sudden Guy reappears and he's in his kayak. You know, and then he starts, I guess, transmogrifying and turning into different animals, spirit forms, and I'm chasing him, then it culminates at back on Camp, you know, on the Matole River, really just right near Camp Matole, and everything that I was chasing after, which is meaning, basically meaning of the meaning of life, that all came together in the poem. There's a reconciliation, I say at the end of the poem that I can actually let Guy go and that I can let my father go. And you know, when I'm reading it out loud, I'm crying, and then I'm saying after the reading, like, well, I guess I haven't really let it go. but I've been told otherwise, that this is the best way to do it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it's compared to the you know, the wedding guest in the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner by Coleridge, but you know, the mariner has to or to compare him to myself to the mariner, but the mariner has to keep telling his tale until he's absolved, I guess.
Right.
You know, just the process of getting through grief.
Well, I think it's a great process for getting through grief. And I think there are writers who are like working something that they don't get a clear sense for that it's done. They're probably shaking their fists at you like, I need to find what I'm chasing.
Right.
Well, this has been lovely. As you know, I really responded to the poem and the manuscript, and I'm really so happy to have had the chance to talk to you about it today. I do want to circle back around to your role as a teacher through Poets in the Schools, because our other big audience is teacher writers who are often thinking both their writerly eye and their teacherly eye. So as a poet in the schools, Dan, do you use any parts of this poem in your teaching?
I have, I've included a little excerpt. In fact, it was part of what I read just now to you. And that's just when I've got all these different lesson plans, of course, some that I've created, and one is actually on redwoods. And of course I try to stay open, like, all right, kids, you know, if you want to write about a different kind of tree, that's okay. And usually I'm just open enough that I'll actually say, if you want to write a poem that's about anything else, go ahead. Just, I'm happy that you're writing a poem. Teachers don't always like to hear that because, you know, they like students to follow instructions. But that's when I use it. Almost always when I teach poetry, I've got a handout with lots of samples of poems on it, from a bunch of kids and from published authors as well. And so I haven't used the whole book, the whole poem as a mentor text. It's maybe too large, at least to do it the way I'm teaching right now. You know, right. I'm just in a classroom for an hour,
right,
doing a lesson plan, but there would be ways to do it. Would I be happy if it were taught as a book in schools or universities? Sure, of course. I think any author, I guess, would be happy. You know, you just want your book to get out there in the world. You want people to love it. So who knows where that's going to go? It's still a baby, just getting out there into the world.
Well, it's just getting out in a big network now. So who knows? You may hear back ways that people can have found to make use of the book as well as to just simply enjoy it. We've whetted the audience's appetite for almost an hour with how great and beautiful this book is, and all the ways of reading it and teaching it and thinking about it. So let's close, Dan, by reminding people, if they aren't at the pharmacy in Arcata, how can they get this book?
Right. Okay. So outside, so in Humboldt, it's in all the bookstores. Outside of Humboldt, it's in some bookstores in California. Otherwise, of course, we are relying on the online world, I guess. You can request your bookstore to order it if you would like to support your local bookstore, because it is available on Ingram. Bookstores can simply look it up. Most bookstores are signed on with Ingram. Not all of them are, and I apologize to bookstores, to those of you who also want it available through other channels. On my website, which is just zevlev.com, there's a page that advertises it, and it lists how to order it through an organization called IndieBound. And IndieBound is an organization of independent bookstores, and you would just you just type in your zip code and it calls up your local bookstore, I think. And, you know, you can just order the book through IndieBound and get it through your local bookstore. Other than that, sure, I can say it, Amazon.
Well, I am really proud to end this interview with you telling us all the ways we can get the book, and reminding us that there are all sorts of ways that might support local merchants and local businesses before we resort to that one-click wonder. So
exactly,
yeah. Nice job.
Thank you so much,
Dan. Is there? I always try to ask people, is there anything I should have asked you but I forgot?
No, I mean, when you and I had been corresponding before, you said, you know, do you want people to take something away from the book? And, you know, I thought, sure, a sense of connection to the earth. And Guy Kuttner was so into preserving our earth that I thought that would be nice to honor Guy. An importance of finding and creating meaning or purpose in one's life, live a fulfilled life. And also, and this would honor my father, who was a historian, how each one of us fits historically in the grand scheme of things. What came before? What's coming after you? What are you leaving behind? So those things are definitely key parts of my book, for sure.
As you can see, I'm an excellent interviewer because I let us save that question for the end, which is
perfect.
Lovely way for us to end. Thank you for your book and for your work in the schools and in the writing project, and for spending an hour with us to talk about it today, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you for making the National Writing Project happen, Tanya. Really appreciate it.
that's a great thing as you know, so many people, but what an honor to have my work named that way. Thank you.
A production of the National Writing Project. NWP. NWP Radio.